Now, with your GoDaddy.com domain registration, as a listener of The Chris Perillo Show, enter code CHRIS1 and save an additional 10% on any order. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.
Hang on, I'll start the interview in a second. I gotta finish this level here. I'm trying to find the invisible dot in Adventure. You know, it's an old Atari game you might have heard of, you know, way back when. Do you still play Adventure?
You know, I have a flashback, and it doesn't have an adventure on it, but I'm old enough to remember the game when it really did come out, so yeah.
Do you remember the invisible dot, one of the world's first video game Easter eggs?
No, I did not know that.
Oh, on the third level... you basically go into the Black Castle, you know, the big Black Castle, and you can't see anything. You have to grab a bridge and go to a certain room and keep wiggling in and out of, like, a certain wall. And I wish I could remember exactly where right now, but it'd be impossible to describe by voice. So you keep moving around until you hear the blink, and that means you've picked something up. And then you take that, you're holding on to something, you're holding on to an invisible dot. It's like a, you know, a large pixel. And you move all the way down to, like, where you start the game, you know, right next to the Yellow Castle, and then right below that, you could in the I guess gateway or passageway below where the White Castle room is, you could walk through that wall and you would get an Easter egg of the game's creators. It'd be like in the middle of the screen, flashing like the Holy Chalice.
Oh wow!
Yeah, I'm an old school gamer.
Well, that's amazing. In Quake 2, we did something similar where there's a hidden room at the last level. And I put pictures of all the developers on these big placards, and if you touched them, they did different things. Like, one character spit out jibs, and at the back of the room, you had this one character with these two girls, you know, kind of, like, taking care of him on his throne. But mine basically inflicted, you know, 50% damage on you. So one guy went through there and didn't save, found the hidden room, and died. Had to do it all over again. So sometimes Easter eggs are funny, and sometimes you get death threats from them.
I love Easter eggs. Now, Paul, you're the creative director for Atari.
Right.
What does that mean? Do you just sit there and go, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, no, it should be blue?
Pretty much. I do a lot of hemming and hawing, you know, dramatically and all that when people show me wacky ideas. But essentially what I do is I work in conjunction with the other leads to be a part of a green light process on concepts, and I also do due diligence and everything. And I'm also like the voice of the developer. Like, we have mostly, you know, people that are used to making money, not games necessarily here. And I have more than 15 years making games. So I say, look, you know, this is what game developers think. You know, we got to do this, or this is too much to ask from them. We got to do that. And so it's a pretty broad reaching job. It's really cool because all the time I spent at a developer, I always wished I could work at a publisher and kind of convince them that this is how developers think. So I get that opportunity like every day here.
Now, when you say you play the voice of the developer, is that a bad guy in an upcoming game, the developer?
Yeah, it should be developers versus publishers. But for me, no, it's mainly to when the publisher wants to ask something unreasonable from the developer, I get to step up and back them up. But I also get to educate the publisher on how the developer thinks and how they work. Because the game developers are pretty kind of a scary bunch, really, for the publisher. You know, it's kind of like, how do they think? What do we do with them if we need something out of them? Or vice versa. You know, when I go to visit the developer, I represent the publisher, and I teach the developer, look, publishers aren't that bad. This is what they need from you.
All right. Now, you seem to be releasing games on a breakneck schedule here. Let me count them up. 4,000 games in the next year. Is that true?
4,000 games?
Yeah. That seems like that amount. You're releasing something, it seems, every other week.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, I think those are patches, but... No. No, we're releasing. We have 10 games lined up over the next probably, what, 10 months?
All right, so you've got about 10 games coming up over the next, well, let's say about a year.
Well, actually, it would be 12 technically over
there. Oh, 12, technically speaking. So that's close to 4,000.
Yeah, it is close. It's very close.
12, 4,000. What's the difference? All right, one of the titles seems familiar, Alone in the Dark.
Yes, Alone in the Dark.
What is that? Is it you just basically, let me guess, you sit in front of the screen and nothing happens. It's just the monitor goes blank, and you need the fastest video card because the blackness of the screen won't move fast enough because you're using a new engine. Am I even close?
That's a really good concept. You know, I think the only thing you're missing is a Kleenex. The Alone in the Dark concept is basically a follow-up from what we did in the mid-90s. You know, the Infogrames game based on the Victorian kind of, you know, suspense game. A lot of people don't realize that Resident Evil and a lot of your horror genre games came from Alone in the Dark. So what the developers at Eden have decided that, you know what, let's relaunch this franchise on the next-gen console. And the best way to do that is to come up with something a little bit different but very familiar with people. One of the greatest things they've decided to do is to make the game not based on a movie, like your typical three-act movie. They're making it based on a television show series, like 24. So each chapter in the game is more like an episode in a TV series, right?
Hmm.
So the interesting thing about that is that whenever you start a level, you get a preview of what's going to happen in that level. And then when you finish it, it ends with a cliffhanger, and then you get a preview of what's going to happen in the next level. So when you start up that next level, you're actually going to get a flashback of what happened, so it brings you up to speed. Now, that allows us to do a couple things that are pretty interesting, given our technology and delivery mechanism now with stuff like Xbox Live and PS3, which is later down the road, we can do add-on content like the Lost episode from Alone in the Dark. So we could just make up something if we had to and say, this goes in between these episodes. Now, the designers are going to have little gaps like that, like you say, like an Easter egg. It's more like an intellectual Easter egg where you say, hey, something happened to this character, but they didn't explain it. It's not that we forgot to explain it. We'll explain it later on through downloadable content.
Yeah. Well, it seems that you're making the game a little more evergreen.
Evergreen is a good term.
Yes, it is. It's also a good tree. Now, can you tell me, Paul, what is a Minimoy?
A Minimoy is a little person that was invented by Luc Besson.
Oh, Fifth Element.
Yeah, Fifth Element, The Professional, Joan of Arc. I mean, this guy is like just huge. He's like the James Cameron of America. He's huge in Europe. He wrote these books called Arthur and the Minimoys. There's four books. They sold about 900,000 copies. It was translated in 20 different languages. It just took Europe by storm. Well, he got to go ahead and got the funding to do a movie. It's a live-action movie in the beginning, starring that really annoying kid from Peter Pan, that Johnny Depp Peter Pan. I forget his name.
Finding Neverland. He also played the kid in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. I can't stand him. He's just so freaking milquetoast nice. And anyway, no. He's a cute, wonderful kid. But what happens is the story is that he lives with his grandmother in this big house, and something happens to where they're going to lose the house because they won't give out all the plot details. But basically, he has to help his grandmother keep the house. Well, tangentially, you have him going in the garden of this house and finding this world of little people that live in the garden. And he somehow communicates with them, and they have a treasure buried in their world that if he helps them get it, it can save both the house and the Minimoys. Because if the house goes, the Minimoys go. So magic is involved. He gets shrunk down to a Minimoy. The exciting thing about this concept is the fact that, like, Madonna is going to be one of the voices. Snoop Dogg is going to be one of the voices. So you have actors, you know, mainstream Hollywood actors getting involved with the project, not just on the game side, but on the movie side. Another thing that was very innovative what they did with this is, you know how we always complain about movies not matching games or games not matching movies? Well, what they did at Etrange Les Belous is they moved the entire game studio to the movie set. So they were there on the set with the other CG folks, and whenever they needed an asset, it was just they burned it on a DVD or dragged it across their intranet, and they had one-to-one correspondence. So you're going to have something in this game that is closer to the movie than I think you typically see.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
And it seems that it's going to be playing on just about every platform, too.
Pretty much. I tell you what, it they have HDR working on PS2, and it looks like a PS3 or Xbox 360 game. Yeah. I mean, in terms of visuals, it looks, and it always happens, as you well know, that at the end of the life cycle of a console, all the games look suddenly so much better than they did before.
Naturally. Speaking of looking better, do you remember the old game Battlezone?
Yes, I do.
I hear you guys are working on a new version for the PSP.
Yes, we are.
Is it going to be Vector?
No, it is not.
Oh!
I agree with you. I share your pain. That's my first inclination, is to make it Vector. Unfortunately, the game is well into production when I got hired. Otherwise, I would have scrapped it and started over. But as it is, it's a pretty neat thing. I mean, it's one of Sony's favorite PSP titles, believe it or not, because it showcases really frantic one-on-one battle. So it's going to capture that deathmatch market. And, you know, my only kind of input or direction to the team that's working on it is to make your opponent suffer. You know, the whole key to deathmatch is to humiliate people. So if you dominate, because that's going to either make you quit or make you just want to play the game forever until you get your skills up to beat them.
Now, on the PSP platform, you guys are also working on D&D, another title? It's
right.
Tactics?
Yes. Tactics.
No, wait a minute. Is this game going to lead to Satan worship? Because I was told growing up that I couldn't do D&D because of that.
Well, if you come to New York, we can show you the altar.
Oh, cool.
No.
Oh.
No, I mean, I dealt with that when I was at id for 4 years. And you know what? You can't argue with people. You know, their perceptions are going to be whatever it is. But with D&D tactics, I mean, it goes back to kind of like the roots of D&D on a handheld. So, I mean, it's a little bit slower gameplay, but it's really exciting because it appeals to the diehard fans as well as the new fans because of the kind of instant action mode that it represents.
Well, I could have used the game in college. I had a roommate my freshman year who I went to high school with, and he would stay up. Pat Carr would stay up to like 3 in the morning rolling the dice and eating Cheetos. And all I heard was shake, 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 rattle, 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 crunch, crunch, crunch.
Well, exactly. And this game really is about the closest you can get to pen and paper gameplay. Now, as a person who doesn't play D&D myself, what I love about this game is that it's completely comprehensive. As you're scanning through, the game moves appear. You can choose. You see your list so that you know what's going on. If my boyfriend were a huge D&Der, to me that's incredibly... It's a whole unknown world, these people who are completely involved in D&D, and this is almost a good way for people who aren't involved in D&D to understand. It's got a lot more pick-up-and-play ability.
And it's also multiplayer, too, so...
Whoa, you know. Wait, Paul, your voice just changed again. I don't know, there's something wrong with the line there, I think. It's like it went really high, and then it went really low. How did you do this?
Well, that if you want.
Oh, there are two people, okay.
When you get Alyssa excited about D&D, you know we're doing something right at Atari, because when women want to play this game, that's how we win.
You know what would get my fiance, who does own her own PSP, by the way, now what would get her to play it more is if you actually, this is the gameplay, this is what she would love. Okay, your character, all they do is buy stuff. That's it.
Really?
That's it. There's no... And you just walk into a store, and you make transactions, and then you own stuff. And you bring the stuff home. Let's make up a word. We can call it crap. And you bring your quote-unquote crap home, and then you store it until your house literally explodes with crap. She would love that game. And you know what? She'd buy that game.
Really? Well, that's the magic bullet?
It's called buy. You know, B-U-Y, okay. Buy. And all you do is just buy things. You don't make any money, but you buy things.
Okay. All right.
You got it?
I'm taking notes.
You got the concept there?
You know what? You'll get the royalty.
All right. I appreciate that. Speaking of classic games, you guys are also working on an Earthworm Jim sequel?
Oh, yeah. Earthworm Jim is so cool because that's one of my personal favorite games in terms of it's so weird and so odd when you first played it that it was just inventive and creative. With the PSP version, you have the 3D Earthworm Jim. You have really classic platform stuff with lots of humor, lots of just kind of twisted takes on things. And they've also evolved the powers of the suit and everything. So it's not just a port, or it doesn't just pick up where the original left off. It actually augments it quite a bit because of the technology that we have.
Really? Yeah. Well, I'm not surprised that Atari has technology, but I mean, this is just going to, is it going to be a good sequel?
I think it's going to be an awesome sequel. I mean, you're going to have multiplayer, you're going to have, you know, a super suit overdrive function where you just kind of spaz out and just destroy everything, kind of Smash Brothers style. Mm. I mean, you know, there's elements in there. You can tell that the guys at Shiny are so damn passionate about this. When they came and gave us the presentation for us to do the game, what really struck me is how much thought they put into this fund. You know, they stressed over and over and over again that this has to be fun. It just can't be gimmicky or techy or something like that.
Okay, now, one of the things that I'm looking forward to is something called Hot Pixel, PXL.
Yes.
And because I'm a more of a puzzle, casual gaming kind of guy, if you look at my Xbox 360 tag, it says recreational. That way I won't get beat up, you know, because if I put family, you know, they beat you up when you do that. So Hot Pixel, or Hot PXL, do you already have a website up and running for that?
Yes, we do.
Now, I understand you're describing it as a Web 2.0 style game. How's that the case? Is it very Ajax-y?
Think WarioWare for adults.
Ah.
So, you know, the challenge is with this game is basically putting some adjectives behind it. But seriously, you tell your friends to have a few beers or get a little baked, and it's like the perfect game to be passed around at your house.
See, Ponzi does better cooking than baking, so we'd probably have to go. You can get cooked, maybe.
Brownies.
And brownies, yeah. Some people like brownies. You know, anyway, that's a different tangent. I should send you her brownies. They're pretty good.
Whoa, okay.
Yeah. So Hot Pixel, just some casual games.
Yeah, Hot Pixel is 200-plus minigames. We're going to try to have about 225, I think, in there. And
wow. Dude, I am so looking forward to that. Is it up now? It's not up yet.
Pardon me? Say it again?
I can hear the voices in your head, Paul.
Yeah. It's a nice voice, trust me. It's my better half.
What I was asking is if they're available now, since the site is up.
No, unfortunately not. But once we get the game shipped, you'll have 50 additional games to download.
Dude. So,
The cool thing about this is I talked to Dijon, who's like the guy. It's a real guy. He's a 33-year-old gamer who has been involved with the underground culture of, like, urban underground in Europe for a long time. So he's had this magazine out where he talks about everything other than mainstream TV, movies, or radio. So the guy truly is the real deal when he come up with these ideas for games, which is the games tell a story. There's 10 chapters that kind of walk you through the urban underground. And it's got a real kind of hip feel to it. And the thing about the games is, you know, there's... Everyone, myself included, you know, the first time I played this, I completely bitched about it, saying, I don't get it. Like, what am I doing? I don't know what to do. And somebody looks at me and goes, exactly. Bruno Bonnell, who is, you know, our leader of our company, is one of the guys that was behind this title. He felt so strongly about it because it's so different, and it's so casual game-oriented that people are going to be so surprised when they get it in their hands, and it's, like, addictive. Like, for people like us who were, like, OCD, you're not going to put that thing down until you conquer it. I was getting pissed off. I'm like, I'm not this stupid. I am not going to let this game beat me. And all of a sudden, you realize you've been playing this game for about 2.5 hours. The goal of just going through the games and everything also is backed up by a pretty kind of random story where you learn about this underground culture through the games that you play.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely different. And like I said, it's very casual from the standpoint that I think men and women are going to get this. It's little kids aren't going to get it, I think, because it's a little bit more mature.
Well, yeah, but, if you're saying it's addictive, much like Ponzi's brownies, by the way.
I'll give you my address.
Oh, well, I don't know if we can ship So you're working on another copy of Neverwinter Nights. I guess it's version 2.
Yes, it is. Neverwinter Nights is classic D&D. It's set in one of the most popular kind of like module for D&D, which is Forgotten Realms. It's very, very just amazingly rich and complex. There's a couple features in there that, particularly, you know, as a former D&D guy that I love, a quarter of the way through the game, you find this rundown keep. In most games, you conquer, you get the keep, you conquer the bad guys that are kind of hanging out there, the robbers, and you move on, go to the next level. Well, guess what? When you conquer these guys that are kind of camping out in this keep, you get to keep it. So you're keeping the keep. Now, later on in the game, if you have not improved the keep, renovated it, taken some of the money and the loot that you get and beefed up the defenses, you get overrun in a certain level, and you lose the game. So you get hints to do this and all that, but it's one of those weird game design elements that people are going to talk about from the standpoint of there's a reason why you're looking at every chest, there's a reason why you're looking behind every bush to find every piece of gold that you can find, because there's a reason for you to spend it, other than just getting new armor and things like that. But Neverwinter is one of those first D&D games, just like PSP, where it's co-op, based on an existing universe and totally endorsed by WotC, Wizards of the Coast. Mm-hmm. And it also features, you know, which I'm sure you'll like, the ability to make your own modules, your own levels. So I know a lot of journalists I talked to said, screw the single-player game. All I want is the tools to make my own levels. And Obsidian has so delivered on that end that they could probably sell the editor to make these levels without the game and still make money from it.
Jeez. Gaming's huge. Absolutely huge.
It's all about the community.
Yeah, that's for sure. And speaking of community, you're going to hit the racing fans, too, with Test Drive Unlimited.
Test Drive Unlimited is interesting because we've invented our own genre. We're calling it MOOR, M-O-O-R, Massively Open Online Racing. But the key is here, it's not just your dad's racing game. What it is something that allows you to interact with other racing enthusiasts who basically want a world where they can just drive around and do what they want. You start a car club, upgrade their parts. It taps into that kind of need for speed, Fast and the Furious kind of culture where your car is part of your identity. And the great thing is we've licensed over 100 different vehicle manufacturers to give us their likeness of their car. There's motorcycles, which for me is exciting because I'm a big bike, you know, rider. So the actual, when you ride the bike, if you download any of the footage that we have from the game trailers, it feels like you're on a bike. Everything from bugs hitting your windshield of your helmet. So there's this level of realism, a level of customization. It doesn't exist in any other racing game right now.
So are you saying I can simulate driving across the country and that's all I do? Like I start in Seattle and then I drive to like Washington, D.C. and see everything?
No. Oh. Unfortunately, it would take a decade to create that much content. So we've decided to restrict everything to Oahu, to Hawaii.
Oh, Oahu.
So we've modeled everything, every blade of grass in that island, and given you the ability to freeform explore it.
Is Oahu then the right size for one of these MOOR games?
There's over 1,000 miles of drivable terrain, and everything was photorealistic, taken from GPS footage, so that every hill you see is actually there on Oahu.
Wow.
All of the buildings would actually be there on the street.
Yeah, and what I mean by that is you're not going to want to drive over everybody's lawn and all that, but you can if you want to, and that's the great part is, we model it down to every detail, giving you the option to explore it. One of the things that interests me is I didn't realize that Hawaii was so white trash, but I think they captured that really well.
So there are a lot of trailers then in the Test Drive Unlimited?
I think they used to be, but once you kick the wheels off and let the grass grow, you can't tell.
Well, there's no tornadoes in Hawaii that I know of, so.
But you know what? I'd rather live in a trailer on a Hawaiian beach than a mansion in Texas, that's for sure. One of the things that we found that we still find amazingly fresh and inventive and exciting is our Dragon Ball Z stuff, if you want to mention that. I mean, we're close to 11 million copies of DBZ. And that's in the game, you know, in the console world, that's a huge number. And what amazed me is every time I went around the floor and I saw a DBZ console where people could play the game, there were people lined up to play it. And what's great about the relationship we have with Bandai at Atari is they listen to our input. They say, you know what? What do Americans want out of this title? How do we get them, you know, playing this game and buying it? as much as the Japanese. Because DBZ is a very revered title in Japan. And the great thing is they take our input and they implement it. And I think it really helps in the sales of the title, but also in the feel of it. I mean, it keeps growing and progressing. And you know, the next version we're going to have come out is going to have destructible terrain and have that next-gen feel to it without compromising the kind of lineage that goes along with DBZ.
Yeah, but you won't be able to drive through trailers on Oahu.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll make a special level for that. That's a good idea.
Just a bonus, level or Easter egg there. You've also got Super DBZ, too, for the PS2.
Yes, we do. And it's a little bit more, I think, hardcore. I mean, personally, I like the simpler. I like the button mashing stuff. I mean, I don't care.
So hardcore in terms of fighting games, you'd have to, hit a certain sequence of, buttons and positions of the controller in order to do something?
Right. Yeah. I mean, combos are very important. Memorizing those combos are important. But also for the people that can get up to that certain super combo, state, it's really satisfying to get that feel of the, the Street Fighter, arcade game style action.
Paul, one of the things that you kind of made me think of this. I'm much like yourself. I'm a button masher. Why don't you make a button mashing fighting game? So you don't know how the character's going to be. Just mash the buttons and then hope something happens.
Well, there's actually, we've discussed this with Bandai about making a mode to where you create your own combo. So, for example, if you're a little bit dyslexic and want to mash the same button 15 times and make something spectacular happen, why not?
No. I mean, like a total button mash. Like, it's just random. Because this way I can hand a controller to, like, let's say my parent or one of them, and they could sit there and mash buttons and they could still beat me.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. I mean, but wouldn't that frustrate you if they beat you, or would you?
No, not really. I mean, who has ever made a button mashing fighting game where all you do is just mash buttons? You do anything. Yeah. You got a basic direction of the player on the screen or whatever, but just mash buttons and you just hope you win.
So kind of like when you went across the street and press the button 15 times and it doesn't really connected to anything, but it's still something happens eventually.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's that level of satisfaction, knowing that I could pick up the game and actually win. Especially when I try to do anything online, or, peer-to-peer or whatever. I always get my ass kicked. Always.
I'm with you, brother. I'm with you. Because the hardcore guys I get tired of getting my ass smoked by them.
Yeah. It's frustrating. So I want a button-mashing mode where I actually have an opportunity to win, even though it wasn't necessarily through skill.
Now, with your GoDaddy.com domain registration, as a listener of The Chris Perillo Show, enter code CHRIS1 and save an additional 10% on any order. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.